All right. Welcome, everyone, to today's deep dive. I am your host, and we've got a really fascinating set of sources to unpack today.
I am so excited for this one. As the resident researcher here, I've been really looking forward to digging into these texts with you.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one.
Well,
we are diving into Immanuel Kant and basically his whole guide to being human. But before we get into the heavy philosophy, let's kind of set the stage for you listening at home.
Right. Setting the scene is crucial here.
So picture this. It is the mid-1700s. You're an intellectual living in Europe. And on one hand, it's an incredibly exciting time. I mean, Isaac Newton has just figured out the math of the universe.
Copernicus has moved the Earth from the center of the solar system. Science is basically winning across the board.
Exactly. It's the height of the scientific revolution. But here's the problem. And it's really the spark for our deep dive today. This massive scientific victory came with a pretty terrifying side effect.
Yeah, it caused a genuine crisis of meaning.
Right, because if the universe is just a giant clock, you know, just atoms smashing into other atoms according to the laws of physics, then what happens to us?
What happens to the human soul, right?
Exactly. What happens to right and wrong?
We look back at the Enlightenment as this era of massive progress, but for the philosophers actually living through it, it felt a bit like the floor was dropping out.
Because if the world is a machine, well, machines don't have a telos.
A telos, yeah, higher purpose. A clock doesn't care if it's quote-unquote good or bad. It just ticks.
And that is where the fear really set in. You had guys like Thomas Hobbes basically saying, yeah, that's right, we are just biological machines.
Hobbes was viewed maybe a bit unfairly by some, but he was viewed as a hedonist. He argued morality is just a fancy word for seeking pleasure and avoiding pain.
Which terrified people.
Absolutely terrified them. Because if Hobbes is right, then justice and virtue are just fairy tales we tell ourselves to keep from killing each other. There's no objective good.
Everyone was just sort of groping for a way to ground ethics objectively. And enter the protagonist of our deep dive today, Immanuel Kant. The guy who steps in to stop this slide into nihilism.
Though, looking at the source material, if you were casting a movie about a guy saving the soul of humanity, you probably wouldn't cast Kant.
Definitely not. I mean,
yeah.
He wasn't a revolutionary in the streets. He didn't have this tragic, dramatic backstory. He was just a tiny, fragile man living in Prussia, a lifelong bachelor.
And the sources all emphasize just how incredibly boring his life looked from the outside.
Oh, the walking story is my absolute favorite detail about him.
It's legendary. Kant was so disciplined, so obsessed with his routine, that his neighbors literally set their clocks by his afternoon walk.
If you saw his gray coat passing your window, you knew it was exactly 3:33 p.m.
Right. He was a human metronome. But you know that discipline is actually a clue to his philosophy.
He is definitely not a go-with-the-flow kind of guy.
It's not at all. Kant is what the sources call a moral realist. And that's really the mission statement for today's dive. He wanted to prove that right and wrong aren't just feelings.
They aren't just social constructs.
Exactly. He believed moral laws are as real and objective as the laws of physics.
So Newton found the laws of gravity holding the planets in place, and Kant wanted to find the laws of morality holding humans in place.
Precisely. And to do it, he pulls off what he calls a Copernican revolution in ethics.
Okay, let's unpack that, because that sounds huge. Copernicus flipped the universe by saying the Earth revolves around the sun. What is Kant flipping here?
Well, before Kant, people thought morality came from the outside, like maybe it came from God's voice in a book, or maybe from observing what makes society happy. Kant flips it. He says, look inward.
Okay.
He argues that the structure of morality is built into the human mind itself. The texts use the term a priori.
A priori. We see that term a lot in these notes. That basically means from before, right?
Right. Before experience, before you even walk out the door in the morning, your mind already has certain software installed.
Okay, software. I like that analogy.
So in his metaphysics, he showed we have software for understanding time and space. In his ethics, he says we have software for willing, for making choices.
And if we look at that decision-making software, we find absolute commands. So he's saying we don't need to look at the stars to find God. Or morality, we just analyze how a rational mind works.
Exactly. And that leads him to his opening argument, which honestly is one of the hardest hitting opening lines in philosophy.
The goodwill.
Yes. Kant says there's only one thing in the entire universe or even beyond the universe that is good without qualification. And that is a goodwill.
That is a bold claim. I mean, what about intelligence or courage, happiness? Aren't those things good?
Kant says be careful with that. Think about a Bond villain or a master criminal. They are intelligent. They are courageous. They are totally calm under pressure.
Right.
But because their will is bad, because their intentions are evil, those quote-unquote good traits just make them a more effective monster.
That's a really great point. A dumb villain is annoying,
mm.
but a smart villain is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
So intelligence is just neutral. It amplifies whatever the wheel is doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he even says the same thing about happiness. Happiness isn't good if a terrible person is experiencing it. Seeing a murderer happy with his crime, that's not good.
It actually offends our sense of justice when you think about it.
Right, it does. So the only thing that is unconditionally good is the will itself, that decision-making engine, when it is aligned with the moral law.
But how do we know if our will is actually good?
Yeah.
Because I think this is where people get tripped up. Is it just about meaning well? Like, oh, I have a good heart?
No, and this is crucial to understand from the sources. Kant is not about warm fuzzies at all. He makes a razor-sharp distinction between inclination and duty.
Okay, break that down for us. Inclination versus duty.
So inclinations are your desires, your hunger, your thirst, your desire to be liked, your pity, even your love for your kids. Those are biological and emotional pushes.
Things you want to do.
Right, things you naturally want to do. Duty is different. Duty is rational. It's doing something simply because it is the right thing to do.
The source material uses the speed limit analogy, which I think really makes it click.
It's the classic example. Yeah, so imagine you're driving down the highway at 2 a.m. The speed limit is 65. You are doing exactly 65. But why?
Well, usually because I don't want a speeding ticket.
Right. So there's a cop car right behind you. You drive 65 because you are afraid of the fine. Kant says you are acting in accordance with the law, but you aren't acting from the law.
I'm not getting any moral credit for that.
None at all. You're just acting on the inclination of self-preservation.
Okay, so take the cop away. It's 3 a.m., completely empty road. I could easily do 90 and literally no one would know. But I set the cruise control to 65 anyway.
And why do you do that?
Because I guess it's the law, and laws keep people safe.
Bingo. That is a moral act. You are respecting the law because it is the law. You aren't getting a reward. It might actually be super annoying to drive slow, but you do it out of duty.
See, this seems to imply something kind of harsh, though. Does this mean if I actually enjoy helping people, like if I volunteer at a soup kitchen because it makes me feel really good, I'm not being moral?
That is the famous Kant is a killjoy objection. The sources talk about this. He's not saying you have to hate doing good, but he is saying that the feeling good part isn't the moral part.
The moral part is the commitment.
Exactly. If you volunteer only because it makes you feel good, what happens when it stops feeling good? What happens when the work gets gross or the people are ungrateful?
I probably quit.
Right. Inclinations are fickle. They change like the weather. Duty is rock solid. A goodwill keeps volunteering even when it's absolutely miserable simply because it's the right thing to do. That consistency is what Kant is after.
Okay, so we need to act from duty. But how do we actually know what our duty is? I can't just wait around for a burning bush to tell me.
Kant gives us a tool for this, right? He gives us the ultimate tool, the categorical imperative.
This is the jargon-heavy part of the deep dive, but we really need to get this right. He contrasts this with hypothetical imperatives.
Right. Most of our lives are run by hypothetical imperatives. These are basically if-then statements. If you want to lose weight, then eat a salad. If you want customers, then don't cheat them.
They're conditional. Like, if I don't care about losing weight, I don't have to eat the salad.
Exactly. They are advice. But morality, Kant says, isn't advice. It's a command. It's categorical. It has no if. It just says, do not lie, do not murder.
It applies to you whether you want it to or not. It applies to everyone everywhere.
Yes. So the categorical imperative is basically the algorithm for finding morality.
Mm.
And he gives us three ways to run this algorithm, three formulations.
And they're all supposed to lead to the same behavior, but they highlight different angles of why a certain action is right. Let's hit the first one, the universalizability principle.
The literal text says, act only on that maxim that you can at the same time will to be a universal law.
Which is a bit of a mouthful. But it basically translates to, what if everyone did this?
Yes, but we have to be careful here. It's not what if everyone did this and it became super annoying. It's what if everyone did this and it became logically impossible.
The lying promise example from the sources is the best way to see this in action.
It really is.
Right.
So suppose you need money. You ask a friend to lend you $100 and you promise to pay them back next week. But you know in your heart, you're never going to pay them back.
You're making a lying promise.
Right. So I run the test. I imagine a world where everyone who needs money makes promises they don't ever intend to keep. What happens to that world?
Well, pretty quickly, nobody would ever believe promises anymore. If I say, I promise, people would just laugh in my face. The whole idea of borrowing money would vanish because no one would lend.
Exactly. The very concept of a promise relies entirely on trust. If everyone lies, trust vanishes. So a lying promise becomes a contradiction in terms. You are trying to use the system of promising while simultaneously destroying it.
It's like hacking a video game. If everyone hacks the game to win the game, just crashes and nobody wins.
Perfectly put. Kant says this is fundamentally irrational. You are making yourself a special exception to the rules of logic. And that is the absolute essence of immorality for Kant. Acting like the rules just don't apply to you. You want everyone else to be honest so you can trick them.
That makes total sense. It's not about the consequences, it's about the consistency. Now, the second formulation feels a bit more warm and fuzzy. Respect for persons.
The rule here is treat humanity, whether in yourself or in others, always as an end and never merely as a means.
Never merely as a means. This is the one where I always ask about the barista. Like, I am using him to get my morning coffee. He's a means to my caffeine.
And Kant says, that's fine. We are all means to each other in a functioning society. The key word in that sentence is merely, you can't treat the barista only as a coffee dispenser.
Right.
You have to recognize that behind the counter is a rational human being with his own life, his own goals, his own dignity.
So I can't scream at him or trick him or manipulate him to get free coffee.
Right, because if you trick him, if you lie to him, you are bypassing his ability to make his own choices. You're treating him like a tool, like a hammer or a shovel.
And Kant says, that is the ultimate sin, stealing someone's autonomy.
Exactly.
This idea that human beings are ends in themselves, it really feels like the bedrock of modern human rights when you read the text.
It absolutely is. This is exactly why we have informed consent in medicine. You can't just experiment on someone to cure a disease, even if it would save millions of lives, because that one person has infinite worth and cannot be used just as raw material for the greater good.
They aren't just a variable in a math equation. They are a person, which connects perfectly to the third formulation, the autonomous will.
This really brings it all home. Autonomy versus heteronomy. Autonomy means self-rule. Heteronomy means ruled by another.
And usually when we talk about freedom, we mean, I want to do whatever my impulses tell me. If I want to eat an entire cake, I eat the cake. That's freedom, right?
Kant would say, no, that's not freedom at all. That's slavery.
Slavery to what? To the cake.
Slavery to your biology. If you eat the cake just because your blood sugar is low and your dopamine receptors are screaming for it, you are acting like an animal. You're just reacting to stimuli like a billiard ball getting hit by a cue stick.
Oof. That is a harsh way to look at it. So real freedom is ignoring the cake.
Real freedom is the ability to step back, look at the desire, and say, no, that is not what I choose. Freedom is acting according to a law that you give yourself. When you follow the moral law, you are actually obeying your own higher reason. You are legislating for yourself.
That is a total mind bender. Freedom isn't the absence of rules. Freedom is the ability to follow the right rules.
Exactly. Discipline is the path to liberty.
Now, we really have to talk about the dark side of this, or at least the highly rigid side, because Kant definitely has a reputation for being kind of a robot.
He does. He is a strict absolutist. He doesn't like exceptions. He worries that once you start making exceptions, you'll just never stop.
The source material brings up the Gestapo at the door scenario, or in Kant's time, he called it the murderer at the door.
Yeah, this is the sticking point for almost everyone. Imagine you are hiding an innocent friend in your attic. A murderer knocks on your front door, waves a weapon, and asks, is your friend in the house?
Every instinct I have, every fiber of my being screams lie. You lie to save your friend.
Kant says you cannot lie.
Come on, that's insane. If I tell the truth and my friend dies, isn't that my fault?
Kant argues that you are only ever responsible for your own will. If you tell the truth, you have done your duty. If the murderer then goes and kills your friend, that is the murderer's crime, not yours. You cannot control the murderer.
Yeah.
But if you lie, you have corrupted your own soul. You violated the moral law.
I feel like that is where he loses people. It just feels too clean. Real life is messy.
It is messy. And to be perfectly fair to the sources we are looking at, they do mention that modern Kantians, like the philosopher Christine Korsgaard, have tried to fix this.
Oh, really? How do they justify it?
They argue that when someone tries to use you as a tool for evil, like the murderer is doing, they have essentially opted out of the moral community. So you can defend yourself. You don't owe the truth to someone who is actively trying to weaponize it.
That feels like a much-needed update patch for his software. But what about when duties actually conflict? The sources call this lifeboat ethics. Say I have a duty to save my kid, but also a duty to save a scientist who can cure cancer. I can't do both.
Kant hates those scenarios because they usually rely on predicting the future. Like, oh, the scientist will definitely cure cancer. Kant says humans suck at predicting the future. We can't ever know for sure.
That's a fair point.
But if you absolutely must choose, you don't choose based on who you like more. That's just inclination again.
Right.
You have to use reason to figure out which duty is strictly higher. It's a very cold calculus, but it's meant to be perfectly fair. It removes your personal bias from the equation.
Okay, so we've got this extremely rigorous logical machine like ethics. But then right at the end of the analysis, the sources show us a twist, a major plot twist involving God.
It is a bit of a shock, honestly. Remember in his earlier work, The Critique of Pure Reason, Kant basically demolished all the traditional logical proofs for God. He said logic simply cannot prove God exists, period. He was the philosopher who officially separated faith and reason.
But then here in the Ethics, he sneaks him back in.
He does. He calls it a postulate of practical reason. He says, okay, I can't prove God exists as a scientific fact like a rock or a tree. But for morality to actually make sense, I have to assume God exists.
Why, though? Why does morality need God if the whole point was that it's based on pure logic?
He breaks it down into three postulates. These are assumptions we must make to keep the whole ethical system from collapsing. First is freedom. We have to assume we are free. Otherwise, praise and blame make absolutely no sense. You don't put a toaster on trial for burning your toast.
Right. Ought implies can. If I should do something, I must be able to do it.
Exactly. Second is immortality. This one is really fascinating. Kant says the moral law demands that we be perfect. We must have a perfectly good will. But we are messy, flawed humans. We can't reach perfection in just 70 or 80 years.
So we need an extension.
Exactly. We need an infinite amount of time in afterlife to continue our journey toward moral perfection. The quest is just so massive that one life isn't enough.
And the third postulate is God.
Yes. This is all about justice. In the real world, let's be honest, jerks often finish first. Bad people get rich and live happily. Good people suffer terribly. That feels fundamentally unjust to our rational minds.
Feels like the whole system is broken.
Kant says reason demands that eventually happiness and virtue should match up. If you are good, you should be happy. Since that clearly doesn't happen in this life, we must postulate a governor of the universe, God, who has the ultimate power to balance the scales in the end.
So God isn't the source of morality here. He's the guarantor of it. He ensures that doing the right thing isn't all for nothing.
Exactly. And this changed religion forever. It led to what scholars call liberal theology. Religion became way less about miracles and rituals and much more about just ethical living. God is viewed primarily as the moral lawgiver.
It's a very human-centric view of faith. It's almost like faith is serving the needs of ethics rather than the other way around.
And you know, it didn't just change religion, it changed global politics. This whole ethical system culminates in what Kant calls the Kingdom of Ends.
Which sounds a bit like a location in a fantasy novel, the Kingdom of Ends.
It really does, but it's actually a political vision. Imagine a world where every single person treats every other person as an end in themselves. No exploitation, no manipulation, just a systematic, peaceful union of rational beings.
In reading the sources, this wasn't just a daydream for him. This actually led to real-world institutions.
It's mind-blowing. Kant wrote a pamphlet called Perpetual Peace. He argued that nations should sign a social contract, just like individual people do to officially outlaw war. He envisioned a League of Nations.
Well, he literally predicted the League of Nations back in the 1700s.
He provided the exact blueprint for it. Woodrow Wilson was a huge fan of Kant. The League of Nations and eventually the United Nations are direct descendants of Kant's Kingdom of Ends. The whole modern concept of international law, that there are rules that sit above sovereign nations, is fundamentally a Kantian idea.
That is wild. The United Nations basically started in the head of a guy who never left his hometown and took the exact same walk every single day at 3:30.
It really shows that ideas have power. Kant honestly believed that if we just committed to the logic of morality, if we took our own reason seriously, we could actually solve the problem of war.
So bringing this all down to earth for you listening, what is the takeaway here? Most of us aren't out there establishing the UN. We're just trying to get through the week.
I think the biggest takeaway is about human dignity. Kant is telling you that you are not just a bundle of nerves and appetites. You have the power to govern yourself. You have the power to do the right thing, not because it's easy, not because it's popular, but simply because it is right.
It's a call to grow up in a way, to stop being a slave to your moods and your impulses.
Precisely. It is the ultimate empowerment. You are the legislator of your own life. When you act morally, you aren't blindly following rules from the outside. You are respecting the logic within your own soul.
That's a great place to land. And I want to leave you, the listener, with a thought to mull over as you go about your day. We love to talk about freedom. We all say, I want to be free. But usually we mean freedom from rules. Kant really challenges us to flip that completely.
He asked, are you truly free when you follow your passions? Or are you only free when you obey the laws you create for yourself?
Is true liberty actually just perfect self-discipline? It is a tough question, but definitely one worth asking yourself today.
It really is.
Well, thanks for diving deep with us. We will catch you on the next one.